KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scherer this week. Coming up on weekday in the next couple of hours, a lot to get to. Robert Horton will be here. He's seen the new movie, The Hobbit. For those of you who are Lord of the Rings fans, join us about 10:20. We'll hear why he thinks it does or doesn't work. I haven't actually spoken with him. I don't know if it does or not. Staycations, whether we want to stay in town for the holidays or get out into the great Northwest outdoors. Also, news from Canada with Vaughn Palmer. Michael Parks will join us later in the program to talk about the great Northwest businesses, and they're making headlines all around the world. But first, some news. Seven Seattle area school districts have been awarded a $40 million federal Race to the Top grant. As KUOW's Ann Dornfeld reports, the money is aimed at improving academic achievement in high-poverty schools.
White Center Heights Elementary is the poorest school in Highline School District. 94% of the kids live in poverty. Last school year, only a third of the fourth graders passed the state math test. But teachers and kids say an online math program is helping.
I'm dividing my four by whatever number there is. So there's one.
As 9-year-old Jordan clicks the right answer with his mouse, an animated penguin named Gigi waddles across the screen.
Four goals and 16 four times. It feels like it's teaching me something, but it also feels like a game.
The districts that won the grant plan to use it to buy more online math programs like this for kids in low-income schools. The money will also go to help preschools make sure kids are ready for kindergarten, toward free PSAT and SAT tests in high schools, and to provide training for teachers and school counselors. The $40 million grant will be split among seven school districts: Seattle, Highline, Federal Way, Kent, Renton, Auburn, and Tukwila. School and government officials hailed the grant announcement. But some education advocates say Race to the Top grants are just a federal effort to influence local education policy. That's because districts and states need to have teacher evaluations and other policies in place in order to qualify for the money. I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
A program that Congress has extended 10 times over the last 4 years is expected to end this month. It's the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program. The program has been a safety net for 400,000 people in Washington state. But the majority of people who were cut off from benefits before finding work are still out looking for jobs. That's over 80,000 people. KUOW's Carolyn Adolph has this profile of two people who were cut off and continue to struggle.
This is a story about two people who are so different from one another and who have so much in common.
My name is Amy Reed.
My name is Christopher Kloh.
Amy and Christopher both lost their jobs in the recession. Amy because her company made mortgage software. Christopher because the restaurant he worked in closed. Both received federal unemployment benefits for 99 weeks. That's almost 2 years. For Amy, it was a tough adjustment.
I was always very proud that I could work so that my husband could pursue his passion, which is science. I've just always been proud to take care of the income.
During her 99 weeks of benefits, Amy got interview after interview, but never a job.
I would get a little, you know, out of sorts with family and friends who said, "Oh, it's great, you can just stay home." They didn't realize that my income was so crucial to the family.
When the benefits ran out, Amy cut meat out of their meals. Beans only. That way they could keep the mortgage paid and keep her husband in his PhD program. They ate deep into their savings. She dropped the professional memberships she needed to qualify for a job in her field, human resources.
Gosh, it's a slippery slope, and it's hard to stay positive about it because you realize what you're losing.
No, I'm going to definitely take one of these. This will be nice to share with people at the shelter, you know.
Going to the food bank is a regular errand for Christopher Kloh. His unemployment benefits ran out a few months after Amy Reed's. Unlike Amy, he was on the edge in no time. He sold his prized possession to keep his apartment. It was a 1978 Fender Stratocaster.
I named it Vivian. I sold it for, I think, $800, something like that, to just to get my January rent taken care of.
6 months after that, he was evicted, couch surfing, and getting ill. He found his safety net at Harborview Hospital and later with Harborview's Pioneer Square Clinic.
Yeah, it's like Jackie Chan in a movie, like falling out the window, but there's fortunately a canopy that he lands on.
It's not lost on Christopher that he's homeless because his jobless benefits ran out, but he's not angry.
Well, disappointed and sad, but certainly not mad because it was a privilege, which as an American who's paid taxes in the past, I deserved the privilege, but only for 99 weeks.
The state of Washington checks wage records, looking for signs that people like Christopher and Amy have finally found work. 70% haven't. Cheryl Hutchison speaks for the Employment Security Department.
So that's really troubling. It's showing that these individuals who are unemployed for a long term really are having challenges that extend even beyond their benefit.
The question is what's supposed to happen now. In Amy's case, she's okay. Her husband's got his PhD and has a good job.
That's a big change.
But she'll never feel right until she has a job. Christopher has stopped looking for work. He spends his days looking for food, shelter, and medical help. But he's forging on.
I'm trying to meet every challenge in a way that will move me forward.
I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. I'm Andy Hurst. Seattle's Fry Art Museum is celebrating its 60th anniversary. We'll hear from Fry's new curator, Scott Larmore, coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from the merchants at SeaTac Airport, including Africa Lounge on Concourse A, featuring burgers and a wide selection of Northwest microbrews. Information on SeaTac Merchants Mileage Plan participation at seatacshops.com.
We have clouds and rain, 44 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting rain this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today. Temperatures in the mid-40s. We're expecting clouds tonight, some fog overnight, the low in the upper 30s. Cloudy skies tomorrow with a chance of rain, temperatures in the mid-40s.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. A little more than 60 years ago, February 1952, the Fry Art Museum opened its doors to the Seattle public for the first time. The museum had evolved from the private art collection of Charles and Emma Fry. After Charles died in 1940, he left behind more than 200 paintings and money to care for those paintings and to house them in a permanent collection. When the Fry opened, it was the city's first free art museum, and it still is a free art museum. You could say that Charles and Emma Fry's taste in art was conservative. They bought paintings of people, of landscapes, and animals. Under stipulations of their will, those paintings have to remain on display at the museum. But over the past 20 years or so, the Fry has morphed from a quiet place to spend a rainy afternoon into one of Seattle's hippest hangouts. And the man who's just taken over curatorial decision-making at the Fry is Scott Larmore, most recently a proprietor of his own gallery, Larmore Project. Scott Larmore, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you for having me.
You were appointed to this job, I think, in July of this year, and took over when?
The announcement was made in July, and then I formally started in October, the middle of October.
July was 1 month after you closed your long-running Larmore project. You didn't really have much time to go from point A to point B, or had you been planning on taking the job?
Well, conversations with Joanne Bernie Dansker, the director of the museum, began around May, June, and it just so happened that we were in the process of trying to rethink what the gallery was going to be doing in the future. We were looking at buildings, we were looking at new spaces, and then out of the blue, somewhat, Joanne came in and invited me to a meeting, and it was one of those moments where I thought we were talking about an upcoming show that she was working on. And she dropped the invitation, like, would you consider, instead of continuing your gallery, coming to the Fry and working? And it took me about 5 seconds to answer yes, because I instantly recognized what I could possibly do there, what she has been trying to do there for a number of years, the freedom she gives her curators, the freedom she gives the artists she works with. And so I knew that I could sort of fit into that role in an interesting way and continue what I've been doing for Seattle and its artists.
Your official title is Deputy Director of Curatorial and Exhibitions, I think. Collections and Exhibitions. Other than that title, is it Anything Goes? Or what kind of parameters are there at the Fry?
Well, I think my title does put an emphasis on the collection. That's what comes first. And so my responsibility to Charles and Emma and their legacy and honoring that collection is first and foremost in my mind. But that little exhibitions thing at the end is what sort of drew me there. And we are in a very interesting position at the museum where, in some regards, all bets are off. We have been sort of privately funded and sustained for 60 years to house this collection. But from day one, we've also been a museum that was constantly doing contemporary programming from 1952 on when we opened. And so we will continue to do that and honor that tradition as well. So,
Well, I mentioned that Charles and Emma Fry had collected, I think it's 230 paintings, if I'm remembering the number.
232
paintings. And not that long ago, most of them were on display. They were, Joanne, it was one of, I think, Joanne Birnie Dansker, the director of the museum's first exhibitions when she came here, which was to essentially hang them all in the big gallery, cheek by jowl, and it was kind of stunning to see all that artwork.
It was great, yeah. The when Charles and Emma approached city leaders in 1915 to maybe start a museum together, so they met with Dr. Fuller and they met with Horace Henry, and they thought that housing all these collections under one roof would be a good idea. Charles had picked a site up in Volunteer Park, thinking that would be great. The city leaders sort of said nobody wants to go to a museum so near a cemetery. thanks, but no thanks. So what Charles did was he built an extension onto his house, this gallery space, the same dimensions of which are the main dimensions of all of our galleries in the museum. And he invited people in, and he hung his works cheek by jowl, as you say. And so I think Joanne was sort of paying homage to that moment and that tradition, but also to this psychology of what does it mean to invite people in. You know, as a free museum, we are essentially inviting the community in. And I think that mentality and that psychology is really important to what we do.
What exactly is stipulated in the Fry's will in terms of what needs to be permanently on display at the Fry Art Museum?
It's pretty, there's a few lines that I've been sort of concentrating on about the will, and without going into too much detail about this, he's essentially gave the money and the resources to show the works forever for free, and it comes down to that. We are taking some liberties with that mentality
not the for free part, though.
Not the for free, but backing off the notion that all the paintings have to be on display at all times. As I said, we've always done contemporary programming at the museum since day one, and so we're trying to balance that contemporary programming with the collection. And so we will always have the collection on view, but what Joanne is trying to do there is do a series of exhibitions that actually provide scholarship on the collection, because for years it has been on display, but one would say that there hasn't been a tremendous amount of scholarship. So some of her first shows were about articulating some of these connections and doing major shows around a few of our major artists in the collection.
We're talking with Scott Lorimore, who has been on the job at the Fry Museum for 2 months, I believe, exactly.
Just about
2 months. And Joanne Birnie Dansker herself is a scholar of German art, I think. I know she spent quite a bit of time with it. So a lot of the Fry's collection comes from sort of that Central and Northern European tradition, something that she knew a lot about. Do you have a written mission for the Fry at this point that sort of tacks on to what Charles and Emma had thought they wanted?
We are in the process of working that out right now. I think whenever there's a change of guards at any institution, certain evaluations need to happen. And so my first responsibility was to sort of wrap my head around the collection, start to think about what it has done, what it's currently doing, and where we might go. And so To specify a little closer, I think because Joanne comes from the Villa Stuck, where she was the director for a number of years, the Fry actually invited her in as a visiting scholar when Robin Held and Midge Bowman were there. And as that visiting scholar role, she came in and provided information about our collection.
Mm-hmm.
So this was that first step in scholarship. And what's interesting is to think about our collection is sort of based around the Munich Secession. So I'm trying to get to the core of what Munich Secession represents, try and make an analogy to when Charles and Emma started collecting and why they started collecting, whom they were collecting, and then look at our programming through the years and then sort of start to add on to that. And what I've come up with so far is the Munich Secessionists were interested in discernment. They were a reactionary group. They were one of the first reactionary groups in the history of art. The Viennese Secessionists followed after them. And then we start thinking about all the great manifestos at the beginning of the 20th century. And so in this spirit of protest against tradition in some regards and this support of each other as artists, this notion of international exchange, Munich was not only German-based artists. It was artists from all over the world. So I think the Fry is sort of poised right now, similarly with this moment of recognizing who in our community are doing similar things, where are we going based on that?
We have you mentioned that the Fries had met with Dr. Fuller, who started the Seattle Art Museum, and Mr. Henry of the Henry Gallery. There are three museums in town, Fry being the third, three visual art museums. The Seattle Art Museum is a general and wide institution that's meant to be sort of encyclopedic but not deep. How is the Fry Museum different from the Henry Gallery? Both of you focus on contemporary art.
Right. Well, I think I don't want to speak for the Henry entirely, but
you can speak for the Fry, though.
I can't speak for the Fry. I think that as I start to develop programming for the future, the shows that I'm working on are all done in the spirit of what I viewed Charles and Emma doing and what I viewed the Munich Secessionists doing. And so one of the first shows I'm doing is I'm inviting 36 Seattle artists into the museum to create new works on paper. And these artists are being asked to be a part of the show because beyond their own admirable art practice, they are doing things to strengthen our city and doing things to strengthen each other's practice. And so when I say that referring to they either work as professors, they have started alternative spaces, they have started galleries in their own homes, similar to what Charles and Emma did. So it's this spirit of community, this spirit of being always contemporary that I'm going for.
How is being a museum curator different from running your own gallery?
Well, I think it can be argued that I ran a fairly different kind of art gallery.
Yes.
Than I did run it, and it did have an institutional bent. I was always trying to identify artists that were continually pushing their own practice and pushing the boundaries of what it meant to show in a commercial gallery space. And in hindsight, the people that sort of responded to that kind of programming tended to be in the curatorial world, or they tended to be in the critical world, or in the scholarly world. And so the transition is pretty smooth, actually.
You mean not in the art-buying world? Not necessarily in the commercial world?
Well, we kept our doors open for 6 years, so I think that's, considering the economic times we went through, I'm very proud of that fact. And we placed some really amazing works and lots of really great collections, and the number of supporters we had was tremendous. But so the transition from gallery to museum for me is proving to be really easy, and I think it also stems from Joanne's trust both in artists and continually inviting the artists into the museum that challenge her as a museum director, and I'll continue to do the same.
You know, the Fry fits, I suppose, into the loose category of boutique museum, and I mean that in a good way, not a bad way. Museums like the Barnes and the Phillips collections that were private and then were endowed by wills or other kinds of funding to continue after the collectors themselves had passed away. Do you confer with your like-minded curators at these other institutions? I mean, changes that, for example, at the Barnes in outside of Philadelphia, now in Philadelphia, have been really controversial subjects of litigation. Do you confer with those fellow curators? And B, has the evolution of the Fry from strictly showing Charles and Emma's collection to what it is now been a source of contention for anybody?
Yeah, I really look forward to having those conversations with my colleagues in my 2 months here. I haven't had much opportunity. I've met with Dan Cameron, who's now at the Orange County Museum, and a few of my colleagues in the city. And so those conversations will continue. I think how we differ from the Barnes or the Phillips, there's a phrase, you know, are you a collection with a cafe, or are you this active energy-generating site of new ideas and new thinking? And I think we err on that side of continually trying to push the envelope when it comes to exhibition practice. And I look forward to sort of continuing that trend, and Joanne is leading the way.
I mentioned in introducing you that the Fry is just at the end of its 60th year celebration. And to celebrate, this is something that was organized before you came. There's an ongoing, we're sort of in the middle of a 3-month big multimedia cacophonous. it's not an exhibition.
We're calling it a hot mess.
A hot mess. It's called Moment Magnitude MW, which I understand is the symbol in geothermal dynamic sciences or whatever they call it, for Moment Magnitude. A collection of curators, including your wife, Yoko Ott, selected a whole slew of different kinds of artists. It's almost less of an ongoing exhibition than a series of events. I mean, besides Hot Mess, how would you describe what's going on until the end of January?
Yeah, I'm really honored to have inherited some of the energy that this exhibition is generating. I'm also super daunted as to how I might possibly follow this. But I think what the curators were after was asking some of these big questions about what a museum traditionally does. You know, does it just simply indoctrinate or validate artworks and enshrine it in the museum? Or do they invite artists in to do things that aren't quite art yet? So these moments of rehearsal, these moments of practice, these moments of we even had an artist, Wynn Greenwood, in the museum physically making a new video for viewers to sort of witness, and, you know, watching her twist knobs on a control board or move her mouse around might not necessarily be active studio insight, but that sort of messy quality to this and the uncertain outcomes that we're all trying to evaluate when it comes to that. So these time-based things, these moments that are happening in the museum, every week you come there, something new is happening. A new artwork has been entered into the museum. A performer will be in there. An orchestra will be rehearsing a giant piece. And so what does that mean in terms of access? And I think the curators don't know, and that's kind of why they did this, right? They want to see what happens and question what the magnitude of these moments might possibly be.
I should have looked up the definition of museum. I didn't do that. But as you're talking, I'm wondering what your definition is of that word museum or the concept museum.
Yeah, I mean, I was trained as an art historian, and so that those conversations about what a museum is go back to everybody has sort of been questioning this, and, you know, its relationship to the term mausoleum is not lost on me. And as I inherit this founding collection of seemingly old, dusty paintings, I certainly don't want to get there. So, I think what Joanne is trying to do, and she keeps using this phrase, like, what does the museum of the 21st century look like? If we all kind of understand what a museum is, that's one thing. But what is a museum that truly serves its community, truly advances dialogues about contemporary art, about historical art, about scholarship? These sort of really big questions that I just am so honored to be a part of.
No, I should say that I was there on Saturday, and there is, like, this giant room with Lilienthal Zamora's light installation, their Jeffrey Mitchell's latex, I think it is, wall panel sculptures. There's all kinds of things. There's a sculpture that has Jarek Bischoff's written a piece of music for it, and it moves and plays in a kind of
floats in our,
and floats
in our reflecting pool.
But there is also one room where, if you, like my son when he was little, are very partial to the paintings of beautiful ducks and the horses coming out of the burning barn, those are still there.
They are still there.
So you can turn a corner and not know what you're going to find at the Frye Museum.
True.
Still free after all these years. Scott Lorimore's Deputy Director of Collections and Exhibitions at Seattle's Frye Art Museum. And I should say that Moment Magnitude will be changing up. Up is the wrong word. It will be happening until mid-January of 2013. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, and come and check things out on a weekly basis. It's always changing.
94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman.
Author Nassim Taleb predicted the 2008 financial collapse in his book, The Black Swan. Now he'd like to introduce us to a new concept, anti-fragile, things that gain from disorder. His latest book is called Anti-Fragile, The Key to Thriving Amid Uncertainty. Nassim Taleb sits down with KUOW's Ross Reynolds this afternoon at 12:40.
Support for KUOW comes from Cornish College of the Arts, announcing the 2013 NEDDY at Cornish, the annual Artist Award Program in honor of artist Ned Behnke. The 2013 award program opens December 10th. Information at cornish.edu/NEDDY.
Hi, this is Ari Shapiro of NPR News. When you make your tax-deductible donations at the end of the year, please consider donating to KUOW. The news and information that you rely on every day is possible because of listeners who value public radio as an independent news source, people who value it and support it. Please mail your donation in today or go online to KUOW.org. Thank you.
We have clouds and rain, 44 degrees in the U District. We're expecting rain this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today, temperatures in the mid-40s. We're expecting clouds tonight, some overnight fog, lows in the upper 30s.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. Holidays are busy times at airports and train stations and boat docks. Many of us travel this month and we want to spend time with our friends and family, but maybe, just maybe, you've decided to take things a bit easier this winter. Doesn't mean that you can't get out of your everyday rut. What about enjoying this great Northwest that we live in? And joining us to talk about excellent staycations is travel writer Cray Bauer. He writes about travel for msntravel.com. He's author of Northwest Day Trip and Column, which appears in the Northwest Travel magazine. And he also declares the destination of the month for AAAJourney.com. Hello and welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I also want to throw open the phones if people have questions or suggestions. The number is 1-800-289-5869, 1-800-289-KUOW. I think, Cray, we should define staycation for purposes of this conversation. It doesn't mean stay at home with your feet up, although it could, but it doesn't.
No, it's a hard term to define, I think. And what I decided was that it's 3 hours by land, sea, or air.
Okay.
Air is a little bit of a stretch, but really it's by land. And given where we live, you can also be by ferry, of course.
So anywhere that you can get to in less than half a day, and that pretty much will limit us. We'll talk about the Northwest, and we're going to go as far as Montana, but that's it. So staycation. And you've kind of subdivided this into the sort of romantic genre and the genre that you do when you have lots of kids.
Right. Again, the challenge to sort of fit this into a box. And I'm speaking tomorrow night at Columbia Sports where they have a Escape Your Everyday Adventure program. And so I was trying to think as I was putting together my slides, how am I going to really quantify this? And so I broke it into romance, family, and also, of course, we can talk about solitary staycations, which I think are lovely, this idea of going off somewhere by yourself for a couple of days, you know, one of those solitary retreats. This is a great time of year to do it. We're all looking, I think, to bring down the noise a little bit as
I think so. So some folks can think of that as something that you do physically. Yesterday, for example, we heard about a great snowshoeing trip. So some of these destinations are places that you go to participate in the outdoors, but some of them aren't. And let's start with the sedentary is not quite the right word, but the less athletic of the genres, and sometimes those are the romantic ones as well. And we're going to start right in downtown Seattle.
Yeah, I love this idea. I think you can go downtown and go grand and stay at the Fairmont Olympic Hotel. It's a lovely holiday present for someone. Or go chic and stay at the Hotel Alexis or Hotel 1000. Or pick something in between, and then take a ferry crossing over to Bainbridge Island, and go have dinner at the Four Swallows, which, if you haven't been, it's a fabulous rustica Italian restaurant. Very warm room, very inviting, and a converted house. And just walk there, and then have an early dinner, and then hop the ferry back. And again, this is all walking.
One of the things I wondered when I read that suggestion about the downtown hotels, whether there were kind of staycation packages that some of Seattle hotels might offer this time of year.
Oh, they're wonderful packages throughout, I think. I mean, it's hard now. Remember, when I first started doing this, years ago, we would talk about prices, but prices change almost by the hour.
Really?
And the nice piece about being local is that you can say, you know, hey, tomorrow night, let's see what's available. And hotels drop their rates within 24 hours. If they have a vacancy, they'll toss them up on one of the websites.
So if you're feeling maybe financially challenged, is midweek a good time to think of this?
Midweek is great. Tuesday, Monday, Wednesday, those are the slow nights, especially at the hotels that don't necessarily work as well for business travelers, aren't a regular business traveling accommodation. And so you can find that. And it's always worth it. If you're someone who's comfortable doing this, it's always worth a call as well. I mean, you'd be surprised to call.
What can I get this room for?
Yeah. Just
really
just make a call and say, hey, any chance, you know, or this is a special occasion.
Wow.
Possibility, or another way to go, my friends in the hotel industry are going to love that comment, but another way to go is to just say, hey, this is a special occasion. And
what can you do for me?
And be surprised, because we have a lot of hotels, and they're much quieter at this time of year than in the summer. They're really set up for the summer, you know, craziness that comes along.
So if you've been thinking that this would be a great present for your sweetheart, maybe for the holidays, check. I'm all set. I'm thinking I'm running through all the hotel names. I'm ready to make a call. We're talking about staycations and all their permutations with Cray Bauer. And if you've got a question or a suggestion, you can email us. The address is weekday@kuow.org or call 206-543-5869. There are also sort of little drive romantic stay-ishcations. I'm calling them stay-ish. There's one suggestion you had was, now I'm thinking it's the resorts on the coast, you know, the sort of close coast.
Sure. And that's, I think if you, very close by would be to go head up to Willow's Lodge or Salish Lodge. Again, not inexpensive trips, but lovely for special occasion. And then also, though, I'm very excited about Iron Springs Resort in outside of Moquin.
Now, I was there years ago, and it wasn't exactly a romantic place. What's changed?
New ownership. All of the cabins have been renovated. So there are 24 basically brand new cabins, again, in the rustic feel. And everything throughout, you can clearly tell when you're there that these are people locals. local family who care. And I think, like many of us, wanted something on the Washington coast. I mean, I love going to Tofino. Mm-hmm. And the Wiccan Inn Ashin is I think, the most romantic in the Northwest and arguably one of the top in North America.
But that's a little bit more
it's
of
a truck.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's many hours to get there and a ferry crossing, et cetera. Same really going down to Cannon Beach in that area. There's some lovely spots there. And I know a lot of friends here take that long weekend. So I was quite excited when I learned that Iron Springs had gone through this renovation.
You just mentioned Vancouver Island. There's also Victoria, which I'm not sure we all think of as the most romantic little staycation, but it could be.
Oh, it's lovely at this time of year. Bouchard Gardens does a great illumination program. The Oak Bay Hotel just reopened. This is one of these grand hotels. Huh. Again, folks, local investors came in and said, let's make this grand again.
Can you take the boats in the summer from downtown Seattle to Victoria? Or is that
you can, and you can do the Clippers are still running, and so you can go up that way. You come into the Inner Harbor, the Parliament Building is illuminated. The Empress, the great Fairmont Hotel there, is illuminated. But what really impressed me about Victoria is what's going on with their farm-to-table food movement along Cook's Street.
Really?
We think of
how perfect
Victoria sort of doilies in China. In fact, my wife and I bought China there when we first went there 15 years ago. But so it's sort of funny. But Cook Street has a great food scene, great pizza joint, a new hamburger joint. They have a couple really nice bars. And then great boutiques along Lower Johnson Avenue as well.
So you're saying it could rival Vancouver for a fun weekend?
Well, no, I don't. Well, it certainly can for a weekend. There's certainly plenty to do. If you are active, you can still get out and kayak. You can rent a bike, or the Fairmont has bikes for anyone to use and go out on the Galloping Goose Trail.
I mentioned Vancouver because that's also on your list.
Yeah, Vancouver is my go-to spot. As people who read my columns, et cetera, and my articles know, I have this great affinity for Canada. And I was just there again a couple weeks ago doing a story on Gastown. Gastown, I think any Seattleite who goes to Gastown starts envisioning what Pioneer Square could become with a little tender, loving care and also some faith from those of us who don't live in that area. And Gastown has gone from a real skid row, you don't want to cross Hastings mm-hmm. after dark, to now the epicenter of the food and culture nightlife scene. And also during the day, the boutiques as well. There's great shopping there.
It seems that, Vancouver not significantly bigger just in the city itself than the Seattle area is, but it feels a lot more international than Seattle does.
Well, it is. I think, first of all, it benefits from Canada's immigration policies, certainly Canada's relationship within the Commonwealth, huge Southeast Asian population, for example, Asian population, used to be called Hancouver years ago, and still has a very tight relationship with China and Taiwan. But there's just so much going on there. And then if you go over to the North Shore, which we tend to forget about because we're thinking of downtown Vancouver, and we head over and maybe stay at the Pinnacle Hotel, go to the Capilano Suspension Bridge. Great to go in the winter. It's all lit up and there aren't the masses of people. And then head up to Grouse Mountain. So I was thinking about this. I thought in Seattle, we look to see the mountain and see if it's out. So you go up to the top of Grouse, which is really like a Jack Frost and the Beanstalk mm-hmm. situation. You cross the snow line as you go up the tram.
Right.
And then you look to see if the city comes out because you never know. You're above that potential cloud layer.
We're talking with Cray Bauer, and a lot of our listeners are contributing right now before we move from something. And you can actually do some of these little romantic getaways that we're talking about with your family as well. Don't necessarily have to take them to the downtown Fairmont Hotel, but Vancouver's fun with kids. Gerald says that the 2012 expired Chinook books have 2-for-1 ferry walk-on coupons that are good through the end of the year, so you might want to keep that in mind. And Jonathan in Bellevue is getting married right before Christmas. He's looking for some magical, affordable ideas, I think, for a getaway with his new bride.
I think you should look at Sleeping Lady, one of my favorite spots, and I know a favorite of many here at the station because of their cultural programs. Cabins set in a ponderosa pine forest off Icicle Creek in Leavenworth.
No, that's good for a family. You take your family there.
We do. We go and we go to the library, which is this great, you know, dark cabin and play games. And then we go and then our kids are old enough where they can stay in the cabin now. And Allison and I head over to the Grotto Bar. And there's cross-country skiing and lots of snowshoeing. Of course, you can go up to Stevens Pass quite easily from there as well. But also a nice romantic getaway,
right.
I think.
So you could just stay in your cabin if you want.
Exactly right. Maybe go up to there. They have this, it feels as if it's natural, but this wonderful spa hot tub up there as well.
That sounds good. We're talking about staycations, and Noel emails, I think, from Paris. Don't forget Lopez Island.
Yeah, one of my favorites as well. And getting up into the San Juans, I think, is always nice. Dave and I have spoken on KUW Presents quite often about why this is such a great time of year to be in the Northwest, because all the folks who come, and it's wonderful that they come, but you know, who are coming for the cruise ships and things, aren't here. And so you can go up to Lopez or San Juan Island, or looking over into Canada, go to the Gulf Islands, go to Salt Spring Island, which is quite a serious artistic colony there, and go to the galleries and not be bumper to bumper. And, of course, not wait for two or three ferry crossings.
That's what I was going to say. There's not a lot of waiting this time of year necessarily, right. Although a holiday weekend you have to think about.
Oh, I think
even
so.
Even at Christmas time.
Yeah, yeah. But I think midweek and that kind of thing. And so many people we know have that, take that break from Christmas to New Year.
We're talking about places in the Northwest within 3 hours. This is Cray Bowers' extended definition of a staycation. You don't have to stay at home, although that's fun too. You can go downtown to a nice hotel, take a ferry and have a good meal and come back and then get home all in a day. Or you can, you know, make a weekend of it. Beth in West Seattle, thanks for holding. You're on the air with Cray Bower.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just, you know, I feel like a lot of people, I heard you mention Stevens Pass, and that's really close, and our family loves going up there. We found a great little company that has a whole bunch of cabin rentals that we use, Misty Mountain Properties, and we've just loved going both romantic. You know, I've heard you covering all of the gamut here, but, you know, I just love, I don't snowboard myself, but I can sit in the hot tub, or, you know, in the summertime, the kids can play in the river, and people can fish, and it just kind of has something for everybody to do, whether you've got the kids or the, you know, hiking, or I think we're going to maybe plan a snowshoe trip coming up here pretty soon, too, up at Stevens Pass. So I love the cabin rentals because you kind of have everything right there, and it's obviously less expensive because we can bring up all our own food for the week and that sort of thing.
How far in advance, Beth, do you have to make a reservation this time of year?
Well, this time of year, I think things start getting pretty busy, but, you know, as frequent guests of this particular company, they send us out last-minute deals often. And so, like you'd mentioned, you know, if they still have availability last minute, you can call them up the same day, and they'll give you a really good deal. And they had a Chinook book coupon that we used, too, this last year that's expired now. But, you know, free third night, and they're great with last-minute availability. They almost always have something when we call, and they're getting bigger and bigger. So I think a lot has to do with maybe, you know, the economy. A lot of people have their second homes that are now realizing that for rent by owner thing is a really good way to go. So these cabins are somebody else's vacation home, so they're already set up with the games and the movies and all that sort of stuff, and really efficient, you know, cost effective. You can't, there's no way I could afford a hotel room for a family of six or three hotel rooms, you know, and then
right.
Food and all that. So,
right. And I'm right there with you. I have a family of four that's about to grow to five when my 24-year-old comes home for a while, and so I'm always looking for, especially the kitchens. That's just a great saver wherever you travel, if you can find somewhere that has a kitchen that takes care of lunch and breakfast.
Right. Beth, thanks for that. And one thing Beth reiterated that you had mentioned, Cray, was last-minute flexibility. And I guess this is great if you're a spur-of-the-moment person. Maybe we should all become more spur-of-the-moment.
Which I'm not, but my partner is. And so we have that
balance. I'm scheduling trips at the moment into April, but because of my work. For the romantic, for the gentleman who called about getting married, take a look at Treehouse Point in Fall City. And if that's something that's interesting to you, well, I spoke a couple weeks ago on the similar topic at Seattle Athletic Club, and somebody mentioned Treehouse Point, where we went as well. And this is the owner, whose name escapes me, is the treehouse guru. He's written the books,
right,
et cetera.
Right, right.
And there are these wild treehouses where you can go, and I mean, two-story treehouses, all safe, where you can go and stay, and it is very romantic. You go down to the river and there are cairns everywhere. And so the kids love building these little rock towers.
My computer just shut down by itself here. So hopefully I'll be able to figure out if you're calling 206-543-KUOW. Genevieve has just named my favorite place for, it's not quite 3 hours in the winter, but it's close, Mazama Winthrop area.
Yeah. And the Metau is the spot for me. I just love it. It's absolutely four season, 120 miles of groomed cross-country skiing, again, for the romantics. But it's great for kids. You can go skating outdoors on Patterson Lake, make sure that the ice is very thick. There are others who've tested it.
Well, Genevieve suggests the Freestone Inn, which is sort of the top of the line up
right
there.
Right, and Sudden Mountain is the same way. And again, you can find, as the guest was saying, there are people who put their homes on, who put their homes up for rent at this time of year there as well.
Do they still have the Central Reservations booking organization out in the Metau?
I think so. And winter's a big time for them. Of course, there's snowshoeing everywhere. And my thing, as I said, is outside skating, but also the cross-country skiing. And if you have small kids, take them to Loop Loop. I have a story at the moment in Northwest Travel magazine about secret slopes of the Northwest. And this Loop Loop's one of those places, perfect for a three-year-old to get on skis for the first time.
So Loop Loop is a downhill area, right?
It is, but it's a tow rope, and it is a very family-friendly
area. Well, I do have to say I'm a big fan of that. All right, now we've got of telephones back, which is good, and I'm going to go back to the phones, I think. Adam on Mercer Island, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Good morning, you two. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. So being a Northwester, I feel like a staycation. I'm in a constant state of staycation and trying to find a little bit of relief from the weather and the daily grind. And one thing the gentleman here mentioned is, you know, some places offer kayaks and bicycles and ways to get out and enjoy some of the fording weather that we have. And one thing that I have really taken seriously over this last year is flying various kites.
Huh.
And it's really been an exciting adventure because my focus has gone down drastically from what the rain is throwing on top of me versus what the wind's like. And, you know, we all have plenty of awesome layers to keep us well from the rain. So a little bit of rain and lots of wind, it adds color to the sky. It really engages. And for families, you know, having a couple kites in the back of the car, whether or not you go to this place you just mentioned where there's this open area for skiing, you can get up a kite, and if it's small enough or big enough for adults, you can actually have those kites pull you on a sled or skis.
Wow.
And that really can add so much to a day. And even for my short staycations that are in 1 or 2 hour bursts before a day of work, I try to get out to different places by the water and get up a different kite, and it's really something to achieve and engage with.
That's great. Long Beach is one of the great kite flying places in the world.
Yeah.
So,
and that's well within your 3 hour parameter for. Right.
Or anywhere in Washington State. That's my other caveat with staycations.
Okay.
So you can go to the Metau or other places.
Shelley in Bellevue has a family staycation or sort of stayishcation suggestion. Hi, Shelley.
Hi there. I love this segment and hearing about all the places people go. Our family loves to travel to Seabrook, which is also on the Washington coast. In fact, not far from Iron Springs, the other location you mentioned. But we find this to have just enough amenities for our family, with the pool and the hot tub and the little bookstore and the pottery place and a restaurant, but yet still the houses you can rent, like you mentioned, so you have a kitchen for your family and the movies, and we just love to travel there with or without the kids.
And that's a great suggestion. I haven't been to Seabrook since the little bookstore and bakery, et cetera. I know they were planned, but that's a lovely spot as well.
Thank you for that
really
suggestion.
Kind of idyllic.
Seabrook, Washington. We should be making a list. I have to say, I'm so confused by my computer's turning off and turning on that I haven't been keeping a good list of it. But that Seabrook suggestion, Cray, reminded me of friends who like to go to Fort Worden, just outside
right.
of, or in Port Townsend, yeah. I guess, because you can rent one of those Deborah Winger houses from,
right.
from the movie fame, and the beach is so beautiful there.
It is lovely, and the kids, if you have kids, especially tweens and teens, climbing around and all the what are those called, ramparts, or that whole mm-hmm. area mm-hmm. that have the underground military stuff, the old stuff, is they'll do that for hours and hours.
Plus, Port Townsend itself is a lovely place to hang out. I guess I'd put that also on the romantic getaway list.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and some excellent restaurants and beautiful places for walks as well.
Do you go up to Whidbey ever?
I do. I didn't put Langley on the list only because I've spoken about it
so,
you know, so often. I think it's our little bit of New England, frankly, and the idea that you can get there and be pulling into Langley, especially at this time of year, again, non-commuting hours, within an hour, hour and 15 minutes is fantastic.
It is it is easy. Whidbey's very easy, and the shortest ferry ride ever. You almost don't get
right,
out of your car
exactly.
on that one. Hi, Joanne in Columbia City. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. My girlfriend and I go to Orcas Island every year to West Beach Resort because it's just cabins, no phones, no TV, and we play Scrabble for 3 days. And then we go to East Sound to shop because it's so cool and wonderful. But you're right on the Sound. The cabins are terrific. They have a kitchen. We provide our own food, and it's fantastic and not insanely expensive. And right in Paulsbow, there's a little green cat bed and breakfast, which is really charming.
The little green cat?
I think it's called it's Green Cat B&B.
Okay. Well, good. Thanks for those two suggestions. Paulsbow, which is really easy to
right.
get to, and you don't necessarily think of it as a getaway.
No, but this brings the point that the argument I've made with travel media colleagues all over the world, actually, is that I think the Northwest is probably the best staycation area. I know we get a little Seattle love heavy around here, but it really is amazing what you can do in any direction.
And in 15 seconds, you're going to tell me why going to Yellowstone Park fits into the parameters of this.
Okay. Horizon Air, Alaska Airline, 3 hours door-to-door into the Roosevelt Gate. Very simply, 12,000 people go every day to Old Faithful. I watched it by a full moon erupt twice in the winter all by myself. There's cross-country skiing. You can watch the wolf pack because the alpha females are radio-collared with a bunch of wolf fanatics. It's phenomenal.
Go now. Cray Bowers, a travel writer and a frequent guest on KUOW, is going to be talking about winter getaways tomorrow evening at Columbia Sports downtown, part of their Escape Everyday Adventure series. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Mercy. Thank you.
And now, the sound of the day. That's a recording of the sing-along finale at the annual Christmas program performed by preschool and kindergarten classes for the nursing home residents at Martha and Mary in Paulsbow. That's about 80 kids singing, and the residents are joining in. Actually, they're clapping now.
Good tidings for Christmas and a happy new year.
The sing-along's an extension of an ongoing weekly intergenerational program. The kids and nursing home residents do a lot of activities together, arts and crafts to ice cream socials. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Record 30 seconds and send them to us along with the story behind the sound. Email it to weekday@kuow.org with Sound of the Day in the subject line. Coming up, news from Canada, Robert Horton talking about The Hobbit and Northwest business icons here on KUOW.
It's a minute before 10. Stay tuned for NPR News coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from HopeLink, each year working to help tens of thousands of people in the community with food, housing, transportation, and job services. More information this holiday season at hope-link.org. Lend a hoping hand.
Next time on The Takeaway, the secret of pulling out of a recession.
No whining. I mean, that's not acceptable here.
Mayor Mike Rawling of Dallas, one of three American cities.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.